Welcome to the Happy Menopause Podcast with me, Jackie Lynch, nutritionist and founder of the Well 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 Nutrition Clinic, where I specialise in women's health and the menopause. There are multiple ways that diet and lifestyle can support you through the challenges of midlife. And my latest book, The Happy Menopause, Smart Nutrition to Help You Flourish, is packed with all my best nutritional advice to help you tailor your diet to your menopause symptoms. Join me and my expert guests on a journey through midlife in this podcast and find out how you can have a healthy and happy menopause. Welcome to my latest best bit, part of my series to celebrate 500,000 downloads for the Happy Menopause podcast and the chance for you to catch up on some of the brilliant episodes you may have missed. I'm Jackie Lynch, menopause nutritionist, and I launched the Happy Menopause podcast as a monthly show back in 2019 because I felt so strongly that there wasn't enough information out there about the menopause, and especially not about the role of diet and lifestyle in managing symptoms. Since that time, the menopause has had a lot of exposure in the media, which is a good thing, but I still feel that the nutrition side of things is sorely neglected. And that's why I keep going. I must be doing something right if so many of you are listening. And I want to say a big thank you to all of you for tuning in. This highlight focuses on anxiety, which is one of the most underestimated symptoms of the menopause. And yet it's so common. I dive back into season 2 for this best bit, where I chat to Rachel Weiss, accredited counsellor and founder of the Rowan Consultancy. We talk about how to manage anxiety and enhance emotional well-being. Can you talk us through sort of what's going on with us, what's happening to our brain when we experience low mood or anxiety?
Okay, I'll focus on anxiety mainly, Jackie. What happens is our brain gets a false alarm. So there's a part of our brain called the amygdala, which is a tiny little almond-shaped bit right in the middle in the sort of limbic basic area of the brain, and that is our alarm system. So back in the day when we were cave women and cave men, whenever we saw a saber-toothed tiger, the amygdala starts flashing and sending signals going, red alert, red alert. It's like a fire alarm going off. And this was very useful for escaping from the saber-toothed tiger, because when it flashes, the sympathetic nervous system is activated. All the energy goes to our muscles so that we can run, to our legs and to our arms and our fists. We're ready to flee or fight, and we can run away. The blood goes away from our digestive system. And this happens at lightning speed. So it's straight from the amygdala, which is the primitive part of the brain, which works about 20 times faster than the front bit of the brain that thinks logically. So it just happens in a flash, and there we are. What happens with anxiety is false alarm. And our body goes into this state of flight or fight or sometimes freeze when it's not necessary. Like when someone shouts at us in the car park, or when we read the news report about COVID-19, rather unhelpfully, the amygdala gets straight in there before the logical bit of the brain can interrupt. Hang on a moment. And there we are, shoulders tense, heart pounding, shallow breathing, you know, blood away already to run away from the saber-toothed tiger while we're sitting at home looking at the news or hearing some bad news. So that's what happens with anxiety. It's a false alarm. It's our brain trying to keep us safe, saying, stay safe, stay small, you know, don't go outside, don't meet anyone. It means well. It's like a sort of over-anxious parent. I don't know if that helps, or over-anxious friend. Going, don't go out. Don't talk to anyone. Don't do anything. Just stay in bed under the duvet and then no one can get you. So it means well, but I think it helps to talk to our anxiety a bit like we'd talk to an overprotective friend or parent.
So tell it not to worry.
That's right. Rather than saying, don't be silly or don't be stupid or why do I feel like this, we can just go, look, it's all right. And almost stroke ourselves. I sometimes physically do that. Give yourself a real hug, you know, cross your arms and stroke your arms, rub your tummy, put your hand on your heart, do something physical, stroke your hand. Because it's the physical bit we need to get through before any logical thoughts can take over.
Yes, because this is also instinctive. That's the problem, isn't it?
That's it. That's why we need to calm our body first with breathing or stroking before we bring in maybe some cognitive, behavioural, logical thinking things.
I know that neurotransmitters obviously play a key role in mental health. I always think of the brain a little bit like one of those 1950s switchboards that's got all those different wires making unbelievably great connections. But of course, if one of the connections doesn't fire up, then the phone call can't get put through, or in this case, the neural pathway can't work. So does that sort of affect our anxiety and our mental health overall as well?
Very much. There are two ways. When the amygdala is flashing, this primitive anxiety, the neural connections with the prefrontal cortex, that's the logical bit of our brain, don't function. That's why you may have experienced when you're anxious or agitated or angry or scared, you literally can't think logically because that bit of your brain, the neurotransmitters are not. So if you've ever tried telling someone who's in a state and talking to them logically, it doesn't work.
Because that sense of proportion is no longer there.
That's right, which is why before, the first thing you need to do is calm and reassure and empathise. And that calms down the amygdala and lets the prefrontal cortex connect again and the neurotransmitters work, at which point you're ready for life. It's like if I come home from work, as I used to do, and go, bloody traffic, it was awful. That's my amygdala. If my husband then calmly says, you know, why didn't you take the other train or the other route? I'm not hearing it. It's going over my head. 2 hours later, when I've calmed down, prefrontal cortex is working, I might go, which train did you say was better or which route was better?
Yes. But that's not what you wanted to hear at that precise moment.
In the moment, you have to address the primitive brain and just be empathic.
Are there particular factors that will make us more or less predisposed to experiencing anxiety?
Yes.
Is it genetic, for example?
Nature and nurture both contribute. So it can be genetic and also the way you were brought up. If you were brought up to be fearful, to be anxious, maybe just because the adults around you were behaving that way, or maybe because as a kid you had good reason to be anxious and you needed to be hypervigilant and looking out for danger the whole time, or you've had some traumatic experience. So it can be your genetics and your life experiences can make you more anxious. And the thing to remember is you had good, if it's your experiences, that behaviour of stay small, stay safe, be wary was useful at that stage in your life, but is no longer necessary now. And it's a question of reprogramming your brain and your body to realise that. So that can predispose us. And then, you know, since this is about menopausal anxiety, at menopause, the decreased oestrogen can make us more prone to be anxious because our hormones are all over the place. Women who experience postnatal depression or premenstrual syndrome, if you're one of those, that means that hormonal changes in your body affect your mood psychologically. So you're more likely to experience menopausal anxiety.
Yes, that's very true. I think in particular during the perimenopause, you know, with the decline in progesterone, which is very often the first one to start declining of the hormones, that's the one that can very often kick off a lot of the emotional and psychological symptoms. And of course, is often the big player for women who struggle with premenstrual anxiety as well.
Yes. And the other factors, so that's like the physical factors you were mentioning there. Some of the other reasons that menopausal women can feel anxious are also cultural and life stage related. So in some other cultures where older women are respected, there's far less incidence of increased anxiety in the menopause as opposed to in Western culture where we do not value older women at all. So it's cultural factors. What's your view on body image? You know, how our body shape often changes to be a bit more matronly. You know, I'm putting on belly. I never had a belly before and it's just happening now. I haven't changed my diet, haven't changed anything. If that affects your confidence or your self-image, that might contribute to anxiety. Depends on your own views on aging women. And you might be at the stage where you've got elderly or dying parents to worry about, or teenagers who certainly cause anxiety, or an empty nest, or, do you know, it's that stage in life as well as the physical and the hormonal.
I think anxiety is probably one of the most underestimated symptoms of the menopause, actually. We all talk about sort of hot flushes and weight management and so on, but many more women experience anxiety than I think is actually genuinely recognised. What can we do?
Okay, there's an awful lot. So I'll start. I'd group them things you can do to help with anxiety or mental well-being in general. I'll group them under physical things you can do and cognitive, so to do with your thinking you can do. And it's good to do both the physical and the cognitive. But let's start with the physical, because that's often the way in. Like we said earlier, if you start by trying to think positively, it just won't work if your amygdala is still flashing. So physical things, it may sound basic, but breathing is a good thing to do. Now, clearly we're all breathing, but when we're anxious, we breathe quite shallowly.
Yes.
If you've ever watched a baby or maybe a cat or a dog breathing, just think, what do you notice when you watch a baby cat or dog breathing?
Oh, it's nice and slow.
It is, and you can usually see their belly rising and falling.
Yes.
And when they breathe in, it rises because their lungs are filling up with air, and when they breathe out, it falls. So a good thing to do if you're feeling anxious is to try and encourage deeper breathing from your belly. So people listening, just put your hand lightly on your belly now. Breathe out. Do quite a strong breathe out, like you're blowing out birthday candles back in the day when we did those things. And then you'll naturally breathe in, and I'm hoping you will feel your belly expand if you've got your hand lightly on your belly. And then blow those candles out again and feel your belly expand. Now, if you don't feel any movement down there, don't panic. It just means you've stopped doing belly breathing, and you're probably just breathing from your ribs or from the top of your lungs. So you might want to put your hand on your ribs just under your arm. And again, breathe out, see if there's any movement. So if you can practice belly breathing, just Google diaphragmatic breathing or belly breathing. That helps to calm the body. It's a good thing to do once you notice you're in a state. The first thing is to notice you're in a state. Notice, oh, I'm feeling anxious.
Yes.
That's the first thing, because we get carried away by the anxiety and don't even notice. So to notice I'm feeling anxious, then take maybe 3 good out breaths. And each time you breathe out, just soften your shoulders a bit, or your arm, whichever bit of your body you feel anxiety in. And it's good to practice this with minor anxiety. Don't wait till there's a major thing. Just when you get, you know, annoyed about road rage or burnt dinner or whatever. Yoga is really useful. Any rhythmic movement.
Yes.
Our body gets calmed by rhythm. You know, if you hold a baby, you sort of rock them rhythmically. So we want to mimic that, whether it's walking, cycling, dancing, you know, whatever rhythmic movement, rocking back and forwards, stroking yourself. Try those things and just see what works for you. If you've experienced severe trauma, you may not be in touch with your body. You might not be able to feel things. So please go and get some help from the GP or from talking therapies. All that I'm describing is just really first aid. So that's the kind of physical things, breathing and rhythmic movement.
Right.
And then the cognitive things, like I said, the first thing is really mindfulness. It's being able to notice I'm feeling anxious, as if you're stepping back and observing yourself. And that takes some practice, because that's the prefrontal cortex. That's what makes us different from the animals. We can stand back and observe ourselves and think, oh, I'm feeling anxious,
right,
or I'm feeling scared. Naming the feeling really helps. And then talk to yourself like you would to a good friend. Most of us do not talk to ourselves kindly. We say, oh, you silly person, why are you feeling that? That's ridiculous.
Pull yourself together.
You're inadequate. Yeah, it's horrible. You would never talk to a dear friend that way. So talk to yourself like you would to a dear friend, like, oh, you're feeling scared. Like, I don't know, let me think of it. I've got a minor op on Monday, which I'm scared about. Okay, I don't like going to hospital. It's going to be uncomfortable. So I was doing this to myself yesterday. I said, okay, Rachel, you're feeling scared about that op. That's to be expected. You know, that's natural to feel scared. And I just stroked my upper arm a bit and said, don't worry, you're feeling scared. It's going to be okay. You know, you'll come through this. Think of all the stuff you've come through before in your life. You're going to get through this too. It won't be pleasant, but you'll be okay. Do you know, just talk to yourself whatever language works for you in the way you'd talk kindly.
Yes, that's good advice.
Yeah, you wouldn't say don't be silly or pull yourself together or, you know. And then if you can, locate the part of your body where you're feeling the worry and just soften it a bit. Some people find a worry diary useful. So once a day is half an hour when you're allowed to worry, not just before you go to bed. So maybe 5 to 5:30. Write down everything you're worried about in a little diary and keep that diary. And it's quite sobering to look back over the diary a week later and go, I was worried about that. That never happened.
Right.
You know, if you look back over what you worried about and compared it to what happened, because worry is all about the future.
Yes.
It's future focused. So, which brings me, to one last thing that helps. Worry is when we're focused on the future. So a way to help yourself with worry is to anchor yourself in the present moment. So try this right now. Look around you and name five things that you can see. So I can see, I don't know, a teddy bear, a photo frame, a glass of water, I can see a clock. Just name five things you can see to yourself. Then name four things you can feel. I can feel the socks on my feet, I can feel my trousers on my legs, I can feel my skin on my fingertips, you know, four things. So can you see we're grounding you in your senses in the present moment? You can't be present and worry about the future. Five things you can see, name four things you can feel, list three things you can hear, two things you can smell, and one thing you can taste. And that can just bring you back in the present moment. And whenever you notice your mind going off worrying, which it will, try and bring it back. So I really recommend mindfulness if you can practice any kind of meditation.
That's a really clever and very memorable and easy thing to do as well, isn't it?
I think so, but it's good to practice it when you're relatively calm so that when you are panicking, you can do it quickly.
Right, excellent. And the other thing I'd throw in there as a bit of extra nutritional advice would be to focus on magnesium a little bit, because magnesium is nature's calmer. It really does calm the nervous system and regulate the body's response to stress. So one of the tips I often give people is to have an Epsom salts bath or a foot bath if baths aren't for you or you get too overheated. Mm-hmm. Two or three handfuls of those in the bath, because it's magnesium sulfate, will absorb through the skin, just calms everything down. I mean, the great thing about the bath is, of course, it's me time as well. So you can often sort of shut the door, get away from whatever's bothering you at home and just have, you know, 20 minutes of peace and quiet, let the magnesium do its thing, but also just let your mind calm down as well. So it's a bit of a win-win, that one, I think. There's so much practical advice there, and I hope you found some useful tips to try out. If you'd like to listen to the full episode, you can find it in Season 2, Episode 7. And if you'd like to find out more about good mood food, there's a whole section on nutrition to manage anxiety and low mood in my book, The Happy Menopause, Smart Nutrition to Help You Flourish. It's available in all the usual places. If you're a fan of the podcast, please tell your friends and family, and do give it a 5-star rating and a short review on Apple Podcasts, or whichever platform you listen on. It makes a huge difference to the algorithms which influence the visibility of the podcast, so that more women can find the show. Because every woman deserves to have a happy menopause. I'll be back soon with another Best Bits. Thanks so much for listening. Bye for now.